Like to call the meeting of the House Health and Human Services Committee to order. Welcome everybody for visiting with us this morning. We have interesting agenda. We're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2351, talking about reports of potential abuse at hospital sites, and we're going to invite some testimony on that. Then we're going to have a work session. We're going to change the agenda around and go to a work session on introduction of committee bills, where we will introduce a number of bills, and then we will go on to public comment on mental health delivery. We have a number of people signed up for the public comment on mental health delivery. Looks like about 10 people on that and several people on House Bill 2351. So I think we'll be able to finish on time today in about an hour and a half. So, Steph, do you have some comments?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. On the top of your packet, you had testimony addressed to Chair Dalto from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. That this is their written response to the questions that Representative Tomei and the Chair had requested follow-up information from our presentation last week. So please take a minute to review that and then file it accordingly. I realize it doesn't necessarily go with the materials today, but you might have information on the health insurance mandates and Rocky King's presentation from last Monday.
Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sandy. And it looks like we've received some written testimony on the mental health initiative, so just draw your attention to that. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2351 and welcome Representative Gary Hansen and Gabrielle Rhodes here this morning. Good morning. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always impressed by the committees when I'm sitting on this side. You look a lot more imposing from this position looking up than normal.
That's because you're there and we're here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gabriela Ferreira Rhodes' experience came to my attention last year. I was impressed with her courage in coming forth. With the assistance of Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, this bill was crafted for Legislative Council's review. I believe this bill will strengthen protections for patients, and it carefully does, without affecting other laws relating to sexual abuse reporting protections for children and the elderly. I want a good bill crafted, and am receptive to suggestions from hospital representatives or other members of the public. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding this hearing to accommodate Ms. Rhodes' schedule. And now I'd like to introduce Gabrielle Ferreira Rhodes. Gabrielle.
Good morning, Chairman Representative Dalto and members of the committee. My name is Gabrielle Rhodes. I live at 4533 North Avenue, Apartment 2, San Diego, California, 92116. In early morning hours of May 4th, 2003, I was a patient at Legacy Meridian Park Hospital. Excuse me. An employee came into my room to draw blood and molested me. I had been recovering from back surgery and was very medicated. This man took advantage of my situation and my vulnerability. I was told that the hospital would handle everything for me and I wasn't to worry. But unfortunately, when I phoned back, I was told it was no longer none of my business. When I phoned the police, I learned later that this man had been accused of molesting a patient just 6 weeks prior to my assault, and he was still working with patients. I was so horrified that I knew that something had to be done, that the laws just simply didn't protect everybody. That's when I contacted Representative Hansen and other representatives of the state to help. And I know that this bill will help many, that children and elderly are already protected due to their age and their vulnerability. But when people are ill, and recovering from surgery, they are equally as vulnerable, regardless of their age. This problem, I wish I could say, was isolated, but unfortunately it's not. As I previously said, there was a woman 6 weeks prior to me who came forward, and myself, and as of a few weeks ago, a 92-year-old woman had said she had been raped by a hospital worker in October. This problem has gone on far too long, and it needs to be addressed. And I feel that this bill will help that and help many others. I thank all of you for the opportunity to come and testify before you. It has helped me heal more than you will ever know. And from the bottom of my heart, I thank all of you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of you might have.
More of a comment. After having spent the entire weekend in the hospital, not me, but my daughter, my granddaughter, and a great-grandmother, and seeing how easy it was to go into a room, nobody ever questioned us, and this was a small hospital, so I can imagine it's even more so in a large hospital, and how nobody checks when someone goes in a room, and particularly not a hospital worker, so I can imagine that. I know this must be difficult for you to come forth and say this, and often we don't do this, but you are to be commended for standing up and helping not only yourself and this other people, but everybody in the future from now on. Thank you, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for doing this.
I thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenleck.
Thank you very much for being here today. You're very brave. I'm sure how hard it is. Was the man ultimately convicted?
He was acquitted on my charges, and he still has charges pending against the first victim.
And what were the report? Would this, if we pass this bill, I wouldn't be surprised if we do. Would it have made it easier to convict that man, do you think? Would it have made it the reporting faster? How do you think the bill that we have in front of us would?
Representative, I feel that had this bill been enacted, the authorities would have gotten involved immediately rather than myself having to contact them days later. My nightgown could have been collected earlier to show, you know, fingerprints of the buttons being removed or opened. Statements could have been taken earlier, and also finding out the cases were connected earlier rather than 4 weeks later. I do feel that this man would have been convicted had this bill been enacted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the hospital's defense?
Representative, to my knowledge, the hospital said that they would handle everything, and that they have never taken a position.
That they couldn't reveal anything, or
all I was told was that it was this man's right to privacy and his confidentiality, and that it was none of my business.
Follow up, please. But this did go to court.
Yes, Representative. It eventually went to court a year later, following my assault.
And did you testify at that time?
I did. I testified before the grand jury as well as the criminal proceedings.
Gabrielle, to your knowledge, did the hospital do any sort of internal review? This person, what was their position?
Chairman Dolfo, to my knowledge, he was a laboratory technician. He worked in the lab, a phlebotomist. The hospital, I believe, did do a review and still allowed him to work with patients. He is still there today.
So they didn't, you know, suspend him or tell him he couldn't work any kind of review?
To my knowledge, no. For a few days, I believe he was sent home.
And so I guess I'm having trouble with why the hospital would tell you that it was none of your business at some point when you continued to ask. What justification did they give you for that?
Chairman, I was given no justification. I was told that it was his right to privacy and his confidentiality.
What about your rights?
Apparently they didn't matter.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for staff. I'd like to have the staff take us through the proposed House Bill 2351 to address, number one, how this bill would keep this kind of thing from happening in the future, and number two, how hospitals, how we would propose to be able to address the patient concerns upon, Gabrielle's case, inquiring of the hospital, what are my rights in that process, and then finally, the impact to the both patients' rights and hospital rights or employee rights of those folks who work in hospitals as we process through this. And Mr. Chair, I don't know if that's in order at this time or not. I'll put my request on hold.
Okay, we're gonna take your comments into consideration and get that information for you as we continue to work on this bill and bring it back for a public session so we can have continuous additional work on this. Representative Hansen, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment, probably in summary. The purpose of this bill is to bring vulnerable hospital patients, to give them the same protection that children or elderly have in other medical institutions. Particularly, it's modeled after language that affects how the elderly are protected in nursing home situations. This is a complicated area in terms of HIPAA, patient privacy. But my hope is we can create a climate where these types of incidents are very rigorously examined and there's a lot of communication. There are health licensing boards that should be involved in the discussion of this type of an incident. Besides the criminal charges, where obviously everyone has a right to a trial and are found either found guilty or not guilty at the time of the trial. But there are other steps that can also be taken if these incidences are addressed straightforward, and that could include review by the licensing boards and certainly review by the institutions that are hiring them and bringing them in contact with patients. So again, I'd very much like to thank you for having the hearing and accommodating this road schedule on this matter, and I'm looking forward to an incredible product coming out.
Well, yes, Representative.
Thank you. One further question. Gabriella, did you feel that the police investigation was thorough? Were they?
Yes, I felt.
On your side?
Yes, Representative, I felt it was very thorough. The Tualatin police did an outstanding job.
Well, thanks for coming all this way, and thanks for being here today. And Representative Hansen, thanks for bringing this forward as a bill. Appreciate
thanks.
It. Yeah. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2351, and we will move to a work session on introduction of committee bills. Representative Anderson, a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts in block. He introduces committee bills. Following bills, 921, 1079,
LCs,
1130, 1258, 1259, 1260, 1261, 62, 1964, 2262 and 2263.
Thank you. Representative Anderson moves LC drafts 921, 1079, 1130, 1258, 1259, 1260, 1261, 1262, 1964, 2262, and 2263. Colleagues, these are legislative concepts that have come from various sources that will simply be entered as committee bills, and they will be read into the House, and will be subsequently referred, and we don't even know if they're all coming to this committee, but we're just getting these bills in the process as soon as we can. And your vote this morning doesn't constitute support or opposition to any of these particular legislative council drafts, simply that we are entering them as bills. Is there any discussion? Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I support the motion to accept these as committee reports, but as committee bills. But I would like to put into the record concern that I have on the face of LC 921, which we've only had a chance to look at very briefly, and some committee will get a chance to review it in much more detail. That LC purports to require to allow committees of the Legislative Assembly or members of the Legislative Assembly to have access to confidential public records, whatever a confidential public record is, for the purpose of evaluating the effect on law. And it just is, it automatically raises a concern, and I'm sure the committee that reviews it will pay proper attention to whatever needs to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. I appreciate you bringing that concern to our attention. Just so you know, I think was a bill that came out of some investigations of child abuse. And no, this was child abuse, and this was also the adoptions and some difficulties some members felt that they had in getting information from adoptions to try to advocate on behalf of individuals, families, and children. So hopefully you'll add to discussion when that bill becomes law or becomes a bill form. So, colleagues, is there any objections? Representative Butler.
Just one question, not an objection, Mr. Chair. Sure. Are any of these drafts being brought forward on behalf of any specific group or single individual that need to be mentioned for the bill purpose themselves?
I don't think at this point it's necessary to do that, but if you'd like me to get you that information, I'd be happy to.
So they will be committee bills, not at the request of any individual or group of organizations?
You know, Representative Butler, I'd have to go through each bill briefly to take a look before I can answer that question. Would you like me to do that?
It wouldn't be necessary. I just wondered if there were specific committee or requests of the committee by specific individuals or organizations, just for the record, to list who those might be. Some might be on behalf of hospital organizations, others even on behalf of the departments involved here, to make sure that their regulations are responsive to the concerns of the chair and members of the committee. But that failing, Mr. Chair, I am not objecting. I'm not having had an opportunity to go through these. I will vote with the committee to allow for introduction for the legislative concepts.
Thank you, Representative Butler. There are at least two bills that are coming at the request of associations. There are some that are coming at the request of departments, just taking a brief look at this, a brief gander. And there are others that I have brought forward.
Good.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any objections to the introduction of these bills? Hearing none, the motion passes. Okay. We will close the work session on the bill introduction. We will open a public hearing. We'll open an informational hearing on Oregon's mental health delivery system, and we will invite the various folks that have signed up to testify. So this time, I'd like to call forward Mary Botkin, Tina Turner Moffles, and Judy Redler. Tina, is Joe with you? Okay, and Joe Thurman, can you? Y'all want to come up at the same time?
Yes. Yeah,
okay. And before we get started, it looked like I overlooked somebody who signed up on House Bill 2351, Becky Child. I saw Becky signed up on the other list as well, so I wasn't sure if she wanted to testify on both or just one. So we will come back to a public hearing to allow you to testify on that matter when we have an opportunity. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and committee members. My name is Judy Redler. I live at 15695 South Karras Road in Oregon City. I am a member of NAMI, Clackamas County. I'm a board member, education coordinator, newsletter editor, in our own voice coordinator. I hope that you have seen or will see in our own voice display downstairs. I do that for the state of Oregon. I'm also on a couple of boards that have put together funding and have actually built apartment houses in Clackamas County for the mentally ill. I want to, I realize that particularly this session, money is a huge concern and that you are charged with finding the most cost-effective decisions for dispersing these limited funds. And this morning I would like to give you three ways that I think that you can save money while still delivering better service for the mentally ill. I also want to point out, which you may have heard before, that 1 in 5 people in Oregon suffer with a mental illness. The first guideline I want to give you is that prevention is much cheaper than paying for costly cleanup procedures. I kind of like to liken this to servicing your car, getting the oil changed regularly, and therefore you won't have costly breakdowns. Same thing works with people with mental illness. If they get their medications regularly, it's relatively inexpensive compared to not getting the medications and crashing and burning, being in a hospital, or being in prison. The second guideline is that a lot of this prevention cost can and should be paid for by insurance companies. NAMI has been coming to the legislature for several sessions now, talking to you about passing insurance parity. And I'm sure that you are aware that Oregon is one of the very few states in the nation that has not passed this. This is a bill requiring insurance companies to provide equal insurance coverage for illnesses of the brain as for other organs. If the insurance company would be picking up medications for these people, in the long run would save the state a lot of money. In addition, they've found in all of these other states that the increase in premiums is very, very minimal. That's what you've been hearing from the insurance lobbyists, that it's going to be sky high. Well, we have proof across the nation it is not. So I urge you that when this parity issue hits again this session, to vote for it and to contact NAMI members if you want further details. The third guideline that I'd like to offer you is to move to a less expensive and more effective treatment location to housing within the community as an alternative to the extremely expensive hospital settings. We've all been reading about what goes on with the hospital, and it's been difficult. As a parent, I have a 41-year-old son diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia 20 years ago. And I have learned then the beneficial effects of proper medication. He was in and out of damaged state hospital for 7 years, primarily because none of the medications that were on the market at that time were effective for him. In 1991, Clozaril, one of the first of the new medications, came out. He was one of the first people in Oregon to go on that. At the same time as going on to Clozaril, he got his first placement in a group home. These two things combined have kept him out of the hospital for 13 years. Think of the savings that that has made. And not only the savings in terms of money, but in the savings in terms of human suffering. So, recognizing the importance that the supported, independent, semi-independent housing has been to my son and the other people in Clackamas County that were first in the Clackamas apartments, NAMI began a campaign in 1999 to replicate this model. We have partnered with a lot of people in the community and have gotten 3 housing and urban development grants. We have built these 2 wonderful apartment houses. The people that have been there have been extremely stable, and I think it's due a lot to having a good place to live. In your packets, you will see that I have given you a little sketch of our 3rd apartment house that is due to be built, start construction in June. We had a meeting with the neighbors.
Stop you right there. Judy, yeah. Did you introduce that to the committee? Because I'm not sure that I see the sketch that you were referring.
Okay. Did she give you these with the blue clip? It's in that packet. Here, she's bringing it to you now. Okay.
Left on the ledge.
Thank you.
Okay. As you know, siting housing for mentally ill people in neighborhoods is sometimes very difficult. I've gone through 3 or 4 of these hearings, but just last week we had a meeting with the neighbors around this apartment who were very disgruntled because City Council had again approved and said it was perfectly legal for these people to live there. Still, the neighbors were frightened. It was a wonderful meeting.
Did anybody go to talk to the neighbors ahead of time before the council approved it?
We had plans to do that, and the City Council pulled a surprise on us, put the sign on the lot saying what was going in. So we were kind of doing damage repair at that point.
How often does that happen?
To my knowledge, you know, I think that usually that does happen, that they hear about it before it comes. That's why we had planned to have this done ahead of time.
Do you think we could maybe avoid some of those outcomes of an upset neighborhood by trying to introduce them to your project and maybe some of the folks that are going to live there ahead of time?
Absolutely, and that was definitely in our plans. We had it in the books to do, and we were very surprised that the city surprised us on this. Also on the back of the sheet, there's a list of the people that we have partnered with, Northwest Housing Alternatives, Cascade Management, Clackamas County Mental Health. All of us together have worked. I do need to let you know that this last thing on your packet is an email that I received from the chairman of the Neighborhood Association, who hosted this meeting for us. It was a regular meeting of their Neighborhood Association, and we were very pleased at the outcome. You'll notice in her email there, she mentions that they were expecting people to be very hostile, but they listened very politely. This is a wonderful presentation by all of these people, including 2 of the people who would be on the list to move in. And by the end, there we really saw a turnaround, and you'll notice her last sentence is, "I look forward to establishing a relationship with you and following the progress of the apartments and residents. I feel they will enhance our neighborhood." So we really feel like we're making great inroads, and of course this is going to be a good model for people in Wilsonville to be looking at when we get more of the housing there. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judy, tell me a little bit about, these are very beautiful apartment complexes.
Mm-hmm.
They're individual living, are they group living in small apartment?
Okay.
And what services?
These 2 apartments and our proposed apartments are independent living. There is a live-in manager, but this is not a mental health professional. The people that live in these apartments have reached a level of stability where they self-medicate with the proper medications and do their own cooking. They're mostly, there are 1-bedroom units and some are studios in this apartment. The case managers of these people visit frequently, and this put the neighbors' minds greatly at ease that these people were carefully screened. And in my son's apartment, in Clackamas Apartments, it's been going for 12 years, and there has been very little turnover. These people are quite stable. At the neighborhood meeting that I mentioned, we did have an Oregon City policewoman there, and they asked her how often she had been called to our Fisher Ridge apartments in Oregon City. And she said, "Well, I've only been there a couple of times, and neither time it was for criminal behavior. It was to assist someone who was having a difficult time." this really put the neighbors' minds at ease, and even the police chief has said this, you know, that these apartment houses are, in general, much less trouble than the ordinary apartment house because these people are monitored, they are carefully screened. So that's the big message we want to get out, and we hope to have more and more of these. And it saves so much money over putting people in the hospital.
President Boone.
That's the answer I need, because what are the cost comparisons between hospital care and individual care?
Along with the HUD grant for this apartment house, we also got rental assistance money, federal funds. So the rents on these are under $200, which people on SSI generally have around $500. So they can easily afford to pay their rent and their food there. So the only cost would be, and this is a cost that is ongoing anyway, would be for the case managers for these people. And they just see their clients there in this residence. So,
do you know how much it is, for example, per year for a hospitalization versus?
I don't, but I suspect there are people in this room who do. Can anyone give that figure?
My daughter went in for a 12-day stay, and it was $13,000.
I had a note here, 11, so it was higher than that.
When my son was in Damish 20 years ago, it was $300 a day versus $200 a month, mm-hmm. which the person is paying out of their SSI. So it's tremendous cost savings. And also, it's much better medicine than being in a hospital, you know, being in your own place. I've seen such growth in my son.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express to Judy my thanks and appreciation, offer the support of the chair on this committee on behalf of NAMI, both of Clackamas County and throughout the state. You know, this is a labor of love, and we find that parents and other involved family members who have a family member that's afflicted with the kinds of torments that we see that put people into these situations. Many times, even after that family member is gone, the family continues to advocate on behalf of those who are challenged in this fashion. So,
right.
I just by way of expression, I've got, and there isn't a single representative here, whether we're from the North Coast or from southeastern Oregon, that doesn't have NAMI members that are in our communities and that are the backbone of the volunteer community. And for the work you do, I just wanted to express gratitude on behalf of myself and the several districts of the House that are represented here, that the work you do is very valuable. We appreciate your volunteerism. We appreciate the huge amounts of money that what you do saves the state of Oregon and allows us to address the really critical problems that we have to address. And we need to be able to be of support to you, Judy, and to NAMI. To build up that system of care, which is so very vital at this particular level, that kind of buttresses up the rest of the programs that allows us then to address the really critical areas and issues with the resources, the limited resources that we do have. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. You know, the bottom line is having the right medication. So that's what we're coming to the legislature for, to really back us on this funding of medication. I know that it's a balance between schools and a lot of other places that need the money, but we're talking about people's lives versus with schools they're talking about higher salaries for teachers. So I guess I'm biased there, even though I'm a retired teacher. Thank you very much.
There's probably a little bit more to that than salaries. Judy, don't go anywhere, please. We have a couple other questions. Representative Anderson. Yep. And Representative Greenlee, reserve your comments about the teacher wages.
you'll hear more about that later, I think.
Yeah.
Your son was single.
Yes.
I assume there are folks who are in a married situation who also have problems with schizophrenia or bipolar. What about them? Are these apartments able to take a family of two, or?
Yes. In my son's apartment, one of the women who originally moved in was single, and she got married, and her husband is living there now. They've been living there for 7 or 8 years. And they're a wonderful support to each other.
And in that situation, the rent would change such that he could support her as well?
I'm not 100% sure on that. Actually, in this apartment house also, there's a married couple, too, in Oregon City. I know that when a couple that are on SSI marry, their combined SSI goes down. So they don't get as much money.
Would it be reasonable that maybe she would move out with him eventually and be under his care? Or he under her care?
Well, he also is mentally ill in both of these cases.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Also, in terms of services now, there's oversight to make sure that medications are being taken on a regular basis. Are there other classes or information be given to these folks in terms of bringing them back into the mainstream?
All of the people that are in these apartments are working with Clackamas County Mental Health. And it does include classes. It does include recreation things. Also, our NAMI affiliate in recent years has begun to embrace a great number of consumers in our own voice. This is a group of people with mental illness in recovery who are trained to go out and speak to the community. And actually, one of the residents of this apartment is due to come soon and is going to tell you a little bit about how it has affected his life.
Thank you.
Okay.
Who is that resident?
That's Rich Chernoy.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlake.
Thank you. Sorry, I do want to comment on that comment, and not to pick on you, but we're not Ways and Means, and we have a sort of easier thing, and I just feel how important it is for us to avoid getting into class warfare between classes of categories of citizens who need our help.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one versus the other. We're in this.
Well, it comes down to the same dollar being pulled.
I know.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your testimony that one way to save money would be to have preventive services covered by health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pretty familiar with this field. I wonder if you have a suggestion of the sort of preventive service that, say, I don't know who your health insurer was at the time your son was an adolescent, but say Blue Cross, Blue Shield or something. What sort of service they would have covered that would have been preventive in terms of helping your son avoid the kind of problems he eventually had. Do we know anything that would have?
Well, there is a huge movement in the area of early identification nationwide. That's another program NAMI Clackamas County is involved in called Teen Screen. It was developed by Columbia University. We go out with a computerized program into junior highs and high schools and can get an indication through this computer readout of the students who are suffering with depression, anxiety, or suicide. And the reason I got involved in that is because that would have helped my son be identified a lot earlier and would have helped him a lot. There are a lot of programs now developing when people are caught after their first break and are given services and treatment, and very often that's their only break. And the earlier you catch them, the better.
And follow up. Now, I think that early detection model, particularly in terms of depression, is remarkable, but do you think that's the sort of thing that would be covered under a health insurance program? Or is that something we need to be thinking of doing as a public health?
Well, we're kind of looking at two insurances. One, the Oregon Health Plan for people on Social Security, and the other, the private health plan. And there are a great many people who became ill earlier or later in life, or when it manifested itself later, who are employed and do have private insurance. But there is a cap put on the number of days in the hospital, for example, and on medications. And this is what insurance carries.
I understand that, but okay. I thought I heard you say that if preventive services were covered by health insurance, it would save money. I mean, the example you gave strikes me as an important one because it's a public health activity that could save money downstream, but not necessarily an insurance, although there are some insurance companies that do things similar to that.
Right. Well, there are a lot of therapies and treatments and, well, certainly medications that if these were covered adequately early on when the illness first manifested itself, it would avoid a much greater expense down the road.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Representative. And one last question.
Judy, who paid for the construction of apartment buildings?
The majority of the funds came from Housing Urban Development funds. Our Nami-Clackamas County embarked on a huge fundraising program, of course, realizing we weren't going to be able to raise the amount for this building, but we did raise a lot of seed monies. We also did do the furnishing and paid for that with money that NAMI had raised. I could get you detailed if you would like on where all of these came from. There were several funders of them.
I have a curiosity because we've been doing, I've been doing some work with the developmentally disabled community housing projects that family groups are starting around the state. And so, yeah, I would be very curious to see, to learn more about the way you were successfully able to raise that money. Judy, where is your In Our Voice display? Is it in the rotunda or is it downstairs?
It's in the Galleria.
Down this way. Okay.
Right.
Great. I appreciate you being here this morning.
Okay.
And I just want to say welcome to all the NAMI group that's here in the audience today. Welcome to the Capitol today for your NAMI Day. And at this point, I'd like to invite up Richard Turnoy. Were there other people that were signed up that were part of the NAMI group? Are you Mr. Moore? Greg Swan?
Yes.
Okay, if you'd like to come up as well, that'd be great. We'll have Richard Turnoy, Greg Swan.
Richard isn't here yet.
Oh, he's not here yet. Okay. Greg, why don't you come up, please? And Don Moore, are you with the NAMI group?
I am a member of NAMI.
Okay. Why don't you come on up, please? And is there a Drake Eubank in the audience? Are you affiliated with the NAMI group? Okay. Are you? Okay. All right. We'll have you come up separately. Okay. Greg, if you could introduce yourself for the record and feel free to present. Welcome to both of you.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Dalto and Chair of Committee Persons. My name is Greg Swan. I live at 10480 Southwest East Ridge in Portland, apartment 57. You'll have to excuse me. I'm just a tad bit nervous this morning. So.
No need to be.
I'll try to get through this. And then if I could ask that I have just maybe a brief moment to expound on my written statement, a few comments.
However you'd like to do it.
Okay. I am a client of both the public and private mental health services of this state. I have seen the effect of budget cuts to DHS services. I would like to speak on three aspects. Number one, the access to medication. When the spend down program was discontinued, many like me were left in the situation of relying on drug samples. The loss of prescription coverage for vital medication left me in the frequent hunt for medication. The pharmaceuticals have stepped in with patient assistance programs. However, I do not believe the well of benevolence will be never-ending as the need continues to grow. My time is spent on securing medication rather than focusing on other aspects of my illness and life. Two, how reduction in staff and resources have affected social service agencies. My former caseworker in Lane County is now representing the needs of more than 90 clients. There were times he would spend 15 to 20 minutes on the phone during my therapeutic sessions putting out fires because there were not enough staff for backup. And at this point, I'd just like to say that's an hour-long appointment that I have in 15 to 20 minutes with intermittent phone calls or one long phone call. My therapeutic value was at stake. Number three, the overcrowding of our hospitals and my firsthand experience. In October of 2004, I admitted myself to St. Vincent's ER in Portland. I were told there were no beds and to go back to Eugene where, quote, things are better, unquote. I noticed there were others who had been waiting for 2 or 3 days for a bed. In November of 2004, I was back in Eugene where I was admitted to Sacred Heart Medical Center. There are 36 beds online in Eugene, 9 of which are secure. Occupancy was at maximum capacity the entire time I was there. I spent the next 9.5 days in the hospital. and an incident occurred that extended my stay. One night I was in my room of four when one of my roommates tried to strangle me as I slept. It set me back in my recovery efforts, thus holding up crucial bed space. As a concerned citizen of this state, and as a board member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill at the state level, and as one who faces the daily challenges of having a chronic mental illness, I urge you to find political will to secure stable funding for the already buckling mental health system in this state. It's more than just about medication. It's about access to services. And as Judy had said, prevention is better than treating in the hospital. Once it gets to the hospital stage, it just becomes a revolving door. With the lack of or limited amount of funds that we have for our state and county mental health services for outpatient treatment, we're turning people away, and so the hospital becomes the treatment approach. The sad fact is that the average stay is only 7 days, so the term treat them and street them. They end up back out on the street, back in the hospital, or back in jail. I feel that as a person who has a mental illness, that I'm a viable individual, as are all people that have mental illness. If we're afforded the access to services, we can live at the very basic level a peaceful, quiet life, and in that we are contributing all to our society in this state. Thank you very much for your time.
We appreciate you being here this morning. Thank you, Don. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Moore. I live at 1140 Southwest Stevenson Street, Portland, 97219. I'm also a board member of NAMI of Multnomah County. I kind of wish to talk briefly. I wasn't quite sure what the format was. We're prepared. This is my daughter. And in that respect, she is she's the face of mental illness in the state of Oregon. About 3 years ago, she was attending a private school in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and had an incident where she turned herself into a mental health facility ostensibly to have her blood pressure checked. We got a call in the middle of the night, said come pick her up. And I guess the focus is what we have done in dealing with the system of mental health delivery since that time. Now, I was lucky enough at that point in time to have Blue Cross Blue Shield, which I was in a corporation, got bought out, and then had to buy personal insurance. So as we had the personal insurance at that time, did have an outpatient mental health benefit. As of July 1st of last year, 2004, Blue Cross Blue Shield rescinded all personal policy outpatient mental health coverages by introducing new policies, which we were allowed to convert to, thereby eliminating that coverage for the bulk of the people who have individual policies. As far as I know, it's everybody in the state of Oregon. It doesn't exist. Their answer was, you have this wonderful benefit. It's called one hospitalization every 3 years. So we ended up scrambling to get to, and thank goodness that the state has provided a Oregon Medical Insurance Program, or OMIP. We were then able to convert her over to that and pay the premiums individually, which was something of a blessing. Then we finally got her to Social Security Disability. Social Security Disability says, great, you have health coverage. So the health coverage, okay, what is it? It's Medicare and Medicaid. Oh, okay. Medicare doesn't have any prescription drug benefit, doesn't have any mental health benefits. Okay. What about Medicaid? Sure. All you have to do is take her into one of our providers. And I said, is there any chance that the psychiatrist that she's been working with for 3 years be a provider? Well, no, because the providers are closed and now you have to come back in and drop her treatment program that's there presently. I said, okay, what about prescription drugs? So he said, well, since it's not one of our providers, you're probably not going to get the prescription drug benefit paid for it anyway. So we have to privately buy her health insurance to keep her on the program that she's had for 3 years she's been reasonably successful with. So it's just a real frustrating situation to kind of maneuver through the situation. And I understand this gentleman's concerns in terms of what's there. Luckily, she has us to buy her health insurance, because I would fear what would happen to her if we did not. In the meantime, as of January 1st, we've now cut it down to the benefits in OMIP have been reduced, so that instead of after a certain amount of dollar deductible that they would pay 100% of the medications, it's now an 80-20 copay, no limit. So the costs keep going up. The people that benefit and have some ability to work well with the medications, it's just being reduced further and further, creating more desperate situations for those who can at least afford to do it. So, thank you.
Thanks very much. Don, can I ask you to make some room for Richard, who's joining
sure.
us on the panel, please? Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Those mics are pretty sensitive. It doesn't need to be too good.
Thanks. My name's Rich Ternoy, and I'm really, really nervous. So bear with me.
You're among friends.
Thank you. I live at an apartment complex. It's called Fisher Ridge, and it is designed for folks with various mental and emotional disorders. I've been living there close to 4 years, and I'm 41 years old. And what Fisher Ridge is and what it's done, what it's meant for me, is that it's provided me with safe, clean, safe and sane housing. And it's an opportunity for growth for me. It's an opportunity for me to learn how to work well and play well with others, which occasionally I have some difficulty with.
Don't we all?
And it's a wonderful place to live. It's a great environment for me. I'm attending Clackamas Community College. I'm working, currently studying music, pursuing a couple of degrees. I'd like to talk just for a moment about something which I'm very passionate about. I should mention also, I've been a presenter for NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, for something like three years now. And it's awesome. I really enjoy it. What I'd like to speak to this morning, if I could, is two topics. One topic being medications. That is kind of my main concern. And the other topic being medical insurance. Now, what my situation has been, what my experience has been, is that there seems to be, regarding prescription medications, occasionally the cost of such medications is just astronomical, and many consumers are unable, myself included, to afford the cost of those medications without appropriate insurance. And thank God for the Oregon Health Plan, which I have. Now, if I did not have that, there's no way I could afford the medications I so sorely need. That's one issue. The other issue would be the occasional lack of affordable medical insurance. My girlfriend and myself both have, well, I should say she more than her, but that is an issue for her. Again, without the appropriate insurance, there's simply no way that she can afford this coverage. I'd like to digress for a minute and tell just a really quick story about a friend of mine. My friend's name is Troy. Troy used to live at Fisher Ridge. He's about my age. Troy had schizophrenia. Occasionally, late at night or early in the morning, Troy would talk to his voices. And he was eventually summarily evicted for that, and he learned eventually that, you know, that wasn't appropriate behavior, socially acceptable, that kind of thing. Troy might have done the streets. He might have been homeless. I was homeless. I did the streets for quite a while, years and years ago, back in California where I grew up. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. What I found out, to my astonishment and to my joy, it's just glad in my heart to hear this, is that Troy is not homeless. He found appropriate housing. He found an apartment complex, a residence much like where I live, to help him get back on his feet. So what I want to say is I feel that the astronomical cost of these medications, that I think that needs to change. And I'd also like to say, finally, that I'm just, as I said, I'm very passionate about all these things. There are issues that are very close to me and close to my heart. That it's all, you know, learning, it's all a lesson for me, and it's a gift. And it's all good stuff. And I want to just thank you all for your time and thank you for listening to me.
Rich, thanks for being here. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Rich. Rich, you indicated that the Oregon Health Plan provides the requisite medications.
Mm-hmm.
In for those of your acquaintance and others, what are the key impediments for Troy and others that you see in getting on the Oregon Health Plan?
You know, my sense, I could only speculate, but my sense is occasional lack of social skills, things like that. That's a difficult question to answer. I'm not really sure.
Okay. Not to mention, I think the Oregon Health Plan is closed for new folks to sign up right now. So, you know, even if you were eligible, you probably wouldn't get a slot right now.
Can I comment on that question?
By all means. Representative Greenick.
One of the things that we heard in the discussions on the health plan is that folks who are on Social Security disability, the income level for a single person on Social Security disability puts them just above the criteria level for being able to come on with disability. So when they get qualified for Social Security disability and get that level of income, it moves them to something like 82% of the poverty line, and 76% of the poverty line is the limit for people coming on disabled unless they need home care. If they have a need for home care services, they're eligible with 300%. But we could hear about this the next time we have the folks from Medicaid with us. But that just astounded me when I found out just becoming eligible disqualifies you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks to all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Great. Now I would like to invite up the Ask Me panel. And after the Ask Me panel, we'll hear from Bruce Bishop, and then Becky Child, and then Drake Eubank.
Well, after 2 years, they get on Medicare. Been in the 2 year.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here this morning representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I am not going to take a lot of time this morning myself. I'm going to do some introductions, and then I'm going to let you interact with folks who actually do the work that we all talk about when they go back to work. We represent about several thousand professionals working in the mental health field, both in the community and at the state level and in private nonprofit in the private nonprofit environment. We represent folks who work with the juvenile system, the adult system, and the senior system. We see folks at every stage of their life, and we see folks at every stage of their illnesses. With me today is Scott Webb. Scott is from Ontario, Oregon. He flew over last night so he could spend quality time with his representative. Scott is a correctional officer at Snake River Correctional Institution, but before that, Scott had a previous life, and that life was at Fairview Training Center and in group homes prior to that. So Scott has an interesting and varied background that has qualified him well, both as someone to work with me, but also to work with the legislature and you in identifying some of the problems within this system. Tina Turner Morfitt is sitting next to me. Tina is also a Department of Corrections employee. Tina started her career as a corrections officer at the Oregon Women's Correctional Center here in Salem. Now she works at Coffee Creek at the OCIC, which is the Oregon Corrections Intake Center. And one of Tina's jobs, and she can talk about it more directly, is classification of inmates as they come into the system and to evaluate their mental health needs or to work with the mental health professionals within the system to evaluate those needs and make sure that they access the appropriate care and treatment programs that the Department of Corrections has. Finally, Joe Thurman is a psychiatric nurse at the Oregon State Hospital, and Joe works in the forensics unit at OSH and began his professional career in the private sector, moving into public service in 1988. He's worked at the state hospital since that time and has some rather interesting experience and perspectives on what's wrong with the system. Together, the four of us will attempt to paint a picture of an outdated, underfunded, and at times brutal system of care that is in need of investment and modernization. We will do this from the perspective of the men and women who provide this direct care services to the clients that need those services. I want to say a couple of things, and then I'm going to not talk for a little while. We represent sort of the folks who are our front line of defense against a system that is antiquated at best. What we would like to see in our view of a better system is one that is seamless and integrated, a web of services providing the levels and the types of care necessary at any given moment in the life of a person who has mental health issues. If folks need hospitalization, then we believe they should be given appropriate hospitalization, not for the rest of their life if not necessary, but to stabilize and maintain their ability to function as all the rest of us do in a society that should be free to them as well as it is to us. With that, I'm going to kind of step back and allow our members to speak to you directly, and I'm just going to sit here and answer questions that they can't answer or make notes of questions we need to find answers to. Thank you.
Good morning, committee members.
For the record, my name is Scott F. Webb. Currently reside at 604 East Main Street, Weezer, Idaho. I've been a correctional officer for the Department of Corrections, mainly at Snake Rivers Correctional Facility in Ontario, for about 5.5 years. And in that time, what I've seen, and as a result of this committee, we've identified a list of things, and they're going to be presented to you in no specific order. But from my personal experience, one of the things is our prisons and local jails have fast been becoming the supplemental mental health or the institutions of today. With the closures of Fairview, Damish, the state hospital in Eastern Oregon, and that, that's definitely something that we were expecting to have happen. But what's somewhat unique is the concentration of the people in the facilities for mental health needs is 25%. It's about a quarter of them actually are requiring medication and whatnot to deal with these mental illnesses. Another thing that was identified with this committee was the juveniles were not viewed or accepted as needing the same level of services, nor do we provide them with the same level of treatment, care, or options. The senior citizens also face a similar dilemma as the juveniles. And as we've all been hearing on the news and everything, methamphetamines has definitely played a significant part in this crisis by presenting it with metabolical changes in them and permanent damages that, you know, we have not quite addressed them, or are we recognizing what these long-term damages are going to be? Right now there's been no training or systems implemented for learning how to deal with these this new epidemic. Another thing is the employees are placed in constant danger from lack of self-defense training or training to recognize when self-defense issues would come up. Intervention techniques are sometimes they're oblivious to methods or
symptoms that would lend one to recognize when there would be an intervention needed, appropriate housing alternatives. We're also hampered with limited resources and treatment alternatives. Another thing that we've seen in this up within this group of the members is employees have seen their jobs move from a system of fair compensation and fully funded benefits with a livable retirement to systems that pay, you know, barely above the minimum wage. The health benefits are, you know, just very modest. They're hard to support families and whatnot on some of these that fall in place of what current system has. Clients placed in private hospital settings may receive better care and treatment initially, but this too raises the cost of the care. Since few of these clients have sufficient health insurance, the costs again are transferred onto the Oregon health care, or a hidden cost of uncompensated care borne by the rising cost of health insurance. Again, you heard stated earlier in some of the early testimonies to you that part of the effort to control costs results in shorter stays and less, if any, care and follow-up. An interesting response to these individuals are now placed, if possible, at the Oregon State Hospital or, again, in the prison systems of the county jails. The community providers, last resort, is the county mental health agencies, lack the capabilities or infrastructures and finance base to provide to need the oversight. Treatment, case management, and housing options need to keep the client stable. This results in abuse and neglect for the clients. Worse are the tragedies of poverty exhibited by these clients. The court systems of the mental health was abandoned for a statewide system nearly 30 years ago, and the rationale for this was trying to create an equal system of treatment. Then again, this was abandoned from the state system by ways of going for the private or the more community-based. At the same time, none of these were equally funded. All these savings that were promised in the 80s from doing these things, they've never materialized. That's my part. Thank you.
My name is Tina Turner-Morfitt. Did you want to take questions or shall I continue?
Oh, no, I was just looking around to see if there are questions.
Sorry.
So I'm sort of blind unless I look around here. So well, go ahead.
Okay. My name is Tina Turner-Morfitt. I reside at 748 Meadow Lawn Drive here in Salem, Oregon. As Mary had indicated, I am a corrections employee. Throughout my career, I've been a corrections employee for the last 24 years. Throughout my career, myself and my colleagues have endured an elevated growth of convicted felons within the state of Oregon. Within this growth, there is none more devastating than that of the mentally ill inmates. My testimony today seeks a solution to better equip the men and women who have chosen a career to safeguard the general public in their daily duties of providing care and custody for those who have posed a threat to the safety and security of that very same general public. Our legislation before you today better safeguards not only for for our members, but also for the inmates who are placed under our care and custody for both the adult and juvenile facilities. We are asking today for the creation of training to address a practical understanding of the decompensated behavior of these inmates to better facilitate an understanding of behavior treatment plans and intervention and the prevention of inmate suicides. We want our staff to become better familiar with the onset of crisis episodes so that we don't find ourselves in untenable situations. The purpose of our legislation engages also a task force to develop a comprehensive plan seeking long-term resolutions or solutions to address the needs of the mentally ill inmates, both adult and adolescent. Our legislation highlights the growing needs of the Oregon Youth Authority. While the nature of our request is not to transition our daily functions into that of clinicians, we have a healthy respect for the in-depth knowledge they possess. Our goal is to become a better partner, to be more responsive in the ever-changing inmate population, and to safely return to our individual families at the end of our daily tour. On behalf of my members, I thank you for your patience and cooperation for allowing me the opportunity to address the silent majority behind the prison walls and the ever-increasing need associated with the mentally ill inmates that we supervise.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. The timing is great. We've been, I've been working, and this committee has been working with the mental health system to try to figure out as they plan for the future, any sort of future facility or strengthen the system, planning to deal with these folks that are in the corrections system with mental illness, and how we could take some of the load off of the corrections department with those folks that are living with mental illness and work more closely with mental health folks. So I just wanted to ask you if you've been at the table any sort of discussions about the future of the facility, the state hospital, or mental health as a whole. Has your union been at the table?
Mr. Chair, I understand that we're on the invite list. If it was mailed, we haven't received it yet.
Okay, well, we will explore that issue further. Yeah, Representative Greenlee.
I would like to ask a question. Maybe it needs to wait one more. We're talking about how to tear down the state hospital and create something new. And that's a major... Maybe I should... Should I wait for my question? Good. Let's... let's do one more testimony.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Joe Thurman. I'm a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital. I've been there for since 1998. I live at 411 Black Walnut Street, Jervis, Oregon. And I think we can all agree that the mental health system in Oregon has some serious problems. I think the problems start at the county level and run throughout the system. Oregon State Hospital is now the second most likely destination in that system for the mentally ill, who are not helped by the community system. Most likely destination is corrections. We are also likely destination for sexual predators, methamphetamine addicts, and people with no other problems other than drug and alcohol addiction, who wind up here as a result of failures by the courts and psychiatric review board to appropriately place dangerous criminals. I also treat mentally ill. Once stabilized, patients should be returned to the community for placements that are appropriate to their legal status and illness. An integrated hospital system for forensics and corrections may be a move in the right direction, and I think that addresses what you were...
Well, that's where I'm about to go. So.
The lack of community beds is the core of all the problems at the state hospital. The governor's task force recognized this and stated that they needed thousands more need to be developed. Presently, in the recovery model, which we base our treatment on, there is a contract with patients that if they achieve stabilization, they will be placed back into the community. There's no community placement. There's no money. There's no beds. At this point, we haven't placed anybody in the community, as I recall, in the last 2 months, which causes a backlog within the hospital system. We have made this promise to the people with mental illness in the past when we closed damage. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we have successfully worked with the DHS administration to tear down some of the barriers. Their efforts are appreciated and should be encouraged. Whatever mental health system we adopt, we should be open to view and accountability, not behind closed doors. We are finding it harder and harder to attract qualified mental health professionals who want to do therapy with the mentally ill and find out that they are working instead with more and more criminals. We stay in spite of the better compensation, safety, and community hospitals because we're rewarded by helping the mentally ill and making a difference in their lives. Do we even need a state hospital? I think we do. In fact, Oregon needs hospital-level facilities for two groups. First, the people who have severe mental illnesses that do not respond to community-level treatment. And second, the incarcerated mentally ill need effective institutional care that ensures we can protect the public and them and not release them back into a community where there are no resources. Our jails and prisons should no longer be our number one mental health care provider. This need will be especially critical if you fail to rescue an effective and sustainable community mental health treatment system. If the mental health system is sinking, as it appears to be, Oregon needs the lifeboat of effective and secure treatment-based hospitals. If it does not sink, then we need hospital facilities as transitional tools towards returning to the community. The Ask Me doctors, nurses, correction staff, and community mental health workers have formed work groups to study the system's problems. We hope to be able to help Oregonians and lawmakers step up to the plate and make the changes necessary. Mental health professionals and the communities and corrections need the tools to ensure Oregon treats the mentally ill in the most effective and humane way that our resources allow.
Representative Greenlake.
That segues perfectly into my question. Your statement that prisons should no longer be the number one mental health system leads me to think of the martial arts notion that you take your enemy where it's coming at you. And I've been fairly impressed with the Department of Corrections, with the medical side of that. I've not met with the other side, but I've been very impressed with them. Could not we create legitimate mental health facilities inside the prisons? I mean, if we have 25% of our prisoners need mental health, the notion that somehow they should be taken somewhere else doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, can we recreate state hospital-like services and community-like services inside the correctional institutions?
What's unique about the Department of Corrections, though, is with the drive that would bring an individual to go work for the Department of Corrections compared to the drive of individuals that would want to work with the chronically mentally ill, developmentally disabled, and other capacities. It's a different motivating thing, and that's one of the omissions in the group that you have right now, is that they're not necessarily aware of it. So the pool of employees that you have to work within the system is very small, that actually have that drive, that want. That's not what they initially came in to do, even though they're aware that was a big part of it. The concentration of the ones that have the more severe psychosis, the more episodes that are a little bit more prevalent, is them shock and awe for most of the staff that I've dealt with. They're really surprised by it, if not repulsed, because they're just not familiar with it. So that's a big setback in the Department of Corrections that I've experienced.
I can follow up.
Additionally, what I'd like to add is what you're asking is that can we take this vulnerable population of persons who for some reason find themselves in prison and commingle them with convicts? I mean, people who have intentionally...
I'm not asking that at all. Okay. I'm suggesting that if there needs to be a way to treat patients with severe mental illness in the prison population... The notion is, fine, you move them to the forensic wards of the state hospital. Well, why not have the forensic wards of the state hospital with its mental health staffing, not its correctional staffing, its mental health staffing, inside the correctional institutions, rather than trying to, I mean, we talk about treating them in the community. This is their community. And I was wondering why it's not possible to create a mental health system inside the prisons, a community mental health system inside the prisons, including acute beds for people who need it in that community.
Representative Greenlake, we do currently have units that do deal with that. But again, what we're asking is for training of our staff who have to deal with inmates who, say, aren't manic enough to be placed in one of those, highly needed beds.
And I think we can have some kind of integrated system between the two where they work together as long as it's a hospital-based treatment facility. I think part of the problem is that you're talking about putting mental health facilities in outlying areas. Where are you going to attract the professionals to staff those areas? Where are you going to attract qualified psychiatrists and registered nurses and therapists, psychologists and stuff like that if you're out in the middle of where some of these facilities are?
He almost.
I think he's not your constituent.
Yeah.
The middle of nowhere.
He almost said the magic word. I think that one of the things that we talked about within our work group, and just so you know, we also worked with the Department of Corrections and Max Williams' work group through the Department Managing Mental Illness in Prison. I think that there's two groups here we want to talk about. One is sort of the criminally insane, people who have done very severe offenses, either bodily injury or person-to-person crimes. And then you have the other group of sort of civil commitments that are on the verge of becoming a criminal commitment, and you don't want them to move there. And so I think that, you know, we need beds within the prison system for those individuals who are simply going to be in prison with us. But we also need to have treatment tools and stability tools to keep those folks from deteriorating even further and becoming a more tragic case. We need a different set of beds for folks who just need to be stabilized, who are having a psychotic episode and need to be remedicated and examined and stabilized and then move back out in the community. If you will, you know, sort of the perfect world scenario, I guess, is that we would see some kind of a forensics unit that is co-managed between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Resources or Department of Mental Health Services and other regional facilities that handle non-forensics clients so that they're more accessible to the families and the clients who need them. And, you know, sell the property and take the money. Don't give the money to somebody else. Keep the money yourselves and reinvest it in a better system. Don't let somebody else take the money and reinvest it in something different. Do what we did with the Fairview property and say, when you sell the Fairview property, that money is going into the system for the clients who used to live there and for people who look like them and have the same needs as they do. That's what the money's for. We should do the same thing with the state hospital. Put the money into the system to make the system better so that it is accessible and responsive to the needs of everybody. We have a 10-point program, and I'm running over, and I'm sorry, and I'm
We have a number of questions.
Yeah.
So how long is your 10 points?
Okay, well,
we could read it.
Yeah, well, what we'll do is we'll just dispense with it, given that we've given you it in writing, and so you can go ahead and read it at your leisure, but we do encourage you to read all of our testimony.
These are the 10 recommendations here.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a fine line of treatment of the mentally ill and maintenance of their cases and the temptation to probably over-medicate those that are criminally inclined and that are deficient mentally. And my concern is that patients have rights. Folks in the prisons, in our prison systems that have been properly adjudicated, they have certain rights. I'm concerned that we can't over-medicate, but I'm also concerned with the suggestions that have been made here today that we find a balance within the resources which we have, financial resources. And so, Mr. Chair, I just subscribe that to you. I appreciate Mary being here today and bringing Scott and Tina and Joe. I don't know how she does it, but she's able to tempt somebody from Ontario to come over every couple of years and make a presentation to us. And
it's the bright lights of Salem.
Well, we were looking for a very narrow definition of a bill versus a broad definition of a bill, and somebody said A very narrow bill would be nightlife in Eastern Oregon, relating to the nightlife in Eastern Oregon. But Mr. Chair, I just say this, that I would, I've appreciated Mary's assistance in the past, bringing us solutions, and being a resource, having asked me as a resource for us to try and find solutions, and I just open up the door to make sure that Mary is part of the working group. Anytime we set the table, that Mary be at the table as opposed to on the menu.
What a soundbite. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler. I appreciate those kind words. And I didn't even pay him to say it.
Representative Jensen.
I'm going to basically let most of my questions go, but I'd want to make an observation. Having been around the mental health community for a substantial period of time in the state of Oregon, and going through the deinstitutionalization phase of mental health in the somewhere in the 1960s in this state, and you know, coming down to this point, and the observation is many of the things are perhaps based on good theory that is that are proposed to us, but often are sold under the guise of saving money. And you know, while the deinstitutionalization, and I don't want to get into that topic as such, but may or may not have been a good approach or a good policy, the lack of support that has gone to the mental health community from that time to this time, because this was a quote-unquote cheaper way to do it, if it's cheaper than... as one member of the, you know, I'm always pessimistic about anything that is being done because it'll cost us less money. But, you know, these things are expensive. These are major problems for us. And I don't want to spend money any worse than anybody else does. But if we don't deal with the problems in the right way, we will ultimately spend more money. And having said that, I'll let my questions go that I have had, and realizing we have a full agenda, go on from there, but I couldn't miss this opportunity to editorialize.
Thanks, Representative Jensen. Representative Boone, and then we have to move on so that we can accommodate everybody else that wants to testify.
And I'll leave one of mine off because I think it's in the 10 points there, and that was regarding what you would recommend. So, but I did want to say it kind of, we're going to be doing a tsunami summit after the fact, if you will, and in some areas in Oregon already have plans and everything, but maybe an idea in light of the fact of the meth interjection is a whole different line. I have a degree in psychology too, and I could not imagine working in the trenches as you are all doing so today. And so maybe a mental health summit's in order, and because you truly do need some more tools than you get or have.
Mr. Chair, if I can just close by saying thank you to the committee for your graciousness and your concern, and to assure you that our union will make available to this committee or any work group that the legislature puts together the appropriate people who can bring their expertise to the table, whether it be the doctors and nurses at Oregon State Hospital or those medical professionals working within the corrections facilities or those folks working in community settings. We are prepared to do what it takes to assist the committee in deliberating and finding good solutions and good alternatives for this system. We don't think it's lost. We just think it's really, really broken. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mary, Tina, Joe, and Scott. Appreciate you being here today. I have Bruce Bishop next, and then we will have Becky Child, Drake Eubank, Bob Junedef, Ken Stockcamp, and Judy Wilson. So actually we're just going to have Bruce up, and then we'll invite the rest up. But I just wanted to give you the order.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. With me is Bill Willard, who's the president of OATS and the director of the Child Center in Springfield. We also have in the audience three other day treatment provider directors who are available if the committee has questions. The Oregon Association of Treatment Centers is an association of approximately two dozen community-based nonprofit day treatment programs, many of which have been in existence for 30 or more years, providing mental health treatment services to severely disturbed children in their communities. We're here to talk about the Children's System Change Initiative, about which you heard a little bit on Friday from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and to express the support of the day treatment providers to the Children's System Change Initiative that's underway. What I've distributed for the committee's information this morning is a set of planks that the day treatment providers have developed that express the ways that we think the system should be changed and the steps that are necessary to make those changes effective. We think it's critical that children receive the mental health treatment services, including intensive treatment services, that they need. An intensive treatment services is a specific category of mental health treatment that is regulated by the Office of Mental Health.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlight.
Bruce, could I just have a translation of these terms? Is ITS intensive?
I'm sorry, ITS is intensive treatment services.
ICTS?
Intensive community treatment services.
And you'll talk about what difference that is. And QMHP?
Qualified Mental Health Professional.
And CAS 2?
CASI 2 is the children and adolescent. It's an assessment tool. I can't remember exactly what the acronym stands for, but I have somebody in the audience who can tell you if you'd like. It's an assessment tool that's used to determine the level of need that a child has for mental health treatment services.
Thank you.
Our goal, as we believe your goal, is to assure that children have the services that they need and that those services include the intensive treatment services that are provided by day and residential treatment providers and by hospital services. It's our view that this work has just begun. It was launched, at least from a legislative perspective, during the 2003 session with a budget note on the mental health budget. But we believe that there is much work yet to be done to make sure that the financial and legal resources that are necessary to carry out that budget note's goal are available for the next two-year period in 2005 and 2007. The budget note addressed mental health services, which are a piece of the system of care, but only a piece of that. And as legislators, you have yet to address the entire system. You have yet to come up with policy direction or budget support to make sure that other agencies like the Oregon Youth Authority and Children, Adult, and Families and the Oregon Department of Education are also moving in the same direction as the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in assuring that services are available for children. The budget note started with mental health, but you have more work to do to make sure that that entire system that the state supports for children is working cohesively.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, I wouldn't have any quarrel, I guess, with what you're saying, but do you have any... does anyone have any kind of working figures on what's involved in costs in this?
Mr. Chair, we don't, but we believe that there are significant costs and benefits potentially out of improving the system. We think it's a critical area that the legislature has to address to pull together those pieces, because right now you're spending state resources in a number of different pots, and those need to be integrated into a into an effective delivery system. But there are substantial costs not only in corrections and in welfare and in mental health treatment that have not yet been brought together as a system through the budget note that you heard about last Friday and that we're talking about today. That is something I think this committee can address and can work with your colleagues on in ways and means to have a system-wide approach at the needs of children with mental health problems. Right. You heard about the...
If I'm hearing part of what you're saying correctly, is we're already spending some of the money. It's just not an integrated approach. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. That would...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Renick.
If I can follow that line of reasoning, I think you may have heard me Friday ask the question, the specific question about your treatment services and whether by integrating them and integrating the money, it expanded the availability of, I guess, what would be called ITS. And the argument at that point was that, well, one of the things that was blocking efficient use of the kind of services your providers provide is there was nothing out in the community to move them to, and that by integrating them, it would provide the ability to move people out of intensive services more efficiently and more effectively, and therefore make more intensive services available for others in the community. Has that begun to work? Is there a structure in place for that to actually happen? Is there any evidence that that will happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I think there are examples throughout the state of programs and communities that are making it happen every day already. Whether there is an overall system and policy in the state to make that happen is the question. There have certainly been discussions over the last year and a half about what it would take for the state to facilitate that. So we have examples. It's possible to parlay those examples and disseminate them, but we've only begun that task.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative.
One of the things you heard about on Friday was a delivery system for children's mental health that involves mental health organizations, that involves local mental health authorities, and that will result in determinations about the level of services that are provided that are based on where you reside and what kind of income you have, whether you qualify for Medicaid. It's our view that that is not an integrated system. We do have a disintegrated mental health system today between those multiple layers of state and local government. The goal is to integrate them, but we are far from achieving that goal if we're going to provide the services that mentally ill children need. I'd like to commend to your attention House Bill 2362, which is in the committee's possession. It's a proposal that was initiated by the Oregon Advocacy Center. It is not scheduled for hearing yet, to my knowledge, but it proposes a study of the coordination of services and the creation of integrated funding services to children with severe emotional and mental disorders. We think that kind of legislation is the next step that this assembly should take to pull the pieces together, to get beyond the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, beyond the Department of Human Services, into other areas of state government that are serving the needs of children who are mentally ill. And finally, we believe that it is your responsibility to make those policies and decisions that will integrate the services that will benefit children and their families. The work has begun. It's far from over. I don't want you to be complacent that somehow what happened last session is the end of the work. There's much more work for this committee and other legislative committees to do this year to make that dream a reality. we would appreciate the opportunity to have further discussions with the committee about the children's mental health system in the weeks and months ahead.
Thank you. All right. Appreciate you being here. Okay. I think we're ready for Becky Child and Frank Eubanks. So if you want to come up together, that'd be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Becky Child. I live in Portland, Oregon at 1218 Southwest Washington, number 319, zip code is 97205. I am a person with a psychiatric disability. I've been homeless three different times in my life. I'm also a person who does individual advocacy for folks receiving public mental health services primarily. However, I have done some advocacy for folks receiving private mental health services. And I come to you today with basically four points that I wanted to address with you. And the first one is the state hospital. It's a big topic these days. My concern with the state hospital is that the money needs to follow the people. Whatever happens with the state hospital, if that money is absorbed into other parts of the government, not that there aren't other needed causes, we will continue to see problems that we currently see today in not having enough funding to serve folks, of having the number of folks with mental health disabilities and the prison population increase, and having people have very challenging lives to live, and increasing the number of people that I work with who are not getting their needs met in the current system as it is. Representative Jensen earlier talked about the deinstitutionalization that took place during the 60s. A lot of people say that failed because we deinstitutionalized folks. I disagree. We did not make the money follow the people. That money got absorbed other places. It went back to taxpayers. If the money that had been being spent at that point in time was invested into the community programs, I think we would see a much different community program than what we have today. The next area that I would like to see addressed is a better funding for the Office of Investigation and Training. Part of a good community mental health program is the ability to investigate when abuses do occur. And if we move, I imagine at some point we're going to see a much smaller state hospital than what we currently have. However it's configured, if it's moved to the community, whatever it happens. And for a lot of people who are currently at that state hospital, they consider themselves in one giant big hellhole. And I'm here to tell you that if you make it into smaller and you don't have adequate protections for abuse investigations, then you're just moving them to a community hellhole, which is smaller, but it's still a hellhole. So there's no point in changing the decoration if you're not going to do it right. My third point is the issue of the PSRB. I am all for public safety. I believe in that mission very heartedly. However, as I talk with individuals who are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, I have become convinced that there are times when the administration of the PSRB is bordering on the verge of social control. There's an individual who I've been doing some advocacy for who has tried to get to meetings to voice her experience of what is going on, and she's been told she cannot leave Washington County. When we tried to bring this to the attention, she was afraid of one of the administrators of the PSRB, and so we went sideways and spoke with Mr. Nichol from the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and that came back to her as in, don't ever do that again. You went over my head. It was none of his business. I was just shocked that she would try and, I was just shocked at the response. It's like, she really didn't say that, did she?
Can I stop you there?
Yes.
Did you have a conversation on the phone about that, or in writing, or what?
The person communicated to me in writing what was she had been told by the administrator.
She was told directly, you were saying?
Yes, the person that I was advocating with.
Okay. What do you mean by social control?
It gets into the more details of her situation, but when you're just telling people that they can't say things, that they can't speak to people, as in they can't speak to Bob Nickel about the experiences that they're currently having, to me that's social control. That is not about public safety. The last time I checked, folks under the PSRB still had the freedom of expression. I think that's a basic constitutional right.
But is there some kind of process or some sort of, I don't want to say chain of command, but I mean there's a process.
It's intimidation that borders into social control. It keeps people from moving forward with their recovery. This person is very actively engaged in working on a TAS plan, which is a plan on Social Security. And because of the inadequacy of training for her case manager, they didn't know how to work through the system of the PSRB to help her get her needs met. And so one of the people who's working with her in this process has also been doing some work in Clackamas County and finds that in Clackamas County, she doesn't have the same kinds of problems in getting the needs met for her clients in that county as she does for this woman in Washington County, and believes it's due to the lack of training and knowledge, and it's inequitable.
But you would agree that there is a process within the PSRB to try to work through those concerns, and that it might be counterproductive to draw additional people into it if you're working through that process.
It's an administrative process, and I don't know, quite frankly.
Fair enough.
Okay.
What about the comment about the individual not being able to leave Washington County?
She has some restrictions and on where she is able to travel, and there have been a couple of meetings that have been set up by the OMAS to have folks who are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB and the involved in the criminal justice system, and we've tried to get her there, and she's been told that she can't leave, and because of the process of having to get permission, she's afraid that if she asks for too much that will get denied and she won't be able to get what she wants long term.
Okay. All right, I'll have you move on to your fourth point, please.
All right, my fourth point is the peer-operated services. One of the tools that's been very effective in my life and as I've dealt with the consequences of early childhood trauma is peer-operated services and peer-run services. And the way that the budget's currently established, there's very little money for that, but yet there is documented research and evidence in the addictions arena and emerging research in the mental health arena saying that peer-operated services are an important part of people's recovery process. And the way that the system's currently funded, there are, in some communities, a little bit of peer-operated services, but nothing systematic. And I would like to see that changed. I would like to see more of a focus opened up. And for those of us who have skills and can operate at that kind of a level, that we are able to do that. So those are my comments, and entertain any questions if anyone has any questions.
Okay. Okay, well, what I'll do is I'm going to stay right there. I'm going to close the public informational hearing on mental health, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on, where is it, House Bill 2351, and I'll ask you to provide your comments on that bill.
All right.
We didn't have a chance to do that before.
Okay, thank you. House Bill 2351 came to my attention last night, and I am neither opposed to it or for it. I have some questions about it, and I have some information that I'd like to share with you about it. My question is how is that bill going to be different than what's currently in place, and does it create administrative problems in determining abuse? I was curious how that bill came about. It was a little unclear to me until I heard the earlier testimony this morning, and now that I have my answer. In some of the work I've been doing for the past several years, I've looked at abuse statutes for folks with psychiatric disabilities. And one of the things that we've discovered is that the abuse statutes are very different depending on the population that you are in. If you are a person with a psychiatric disability, what's considered abuse for that category of persons is very different than what's considered abuse for seniors and older adults, and is different also from what's considered abuse for folks with developmental disabilities. And then again, if you have a physical disability or you are a private person in a hospital and you're not receiving publicly funded services, it's not considered abuse in that the state would investigate those services. And so it raises a whole lot of questions. I think that there needs to be a broader discussion than what was done this morning on that bill, and to have some dialogue amongst folks who are concerned about these issues and have responsibility for administrating them.
Okay. Well, you know, we were just starting the discussion about that bill this morning, and we'll do additional work on it. But if you have some specific ideas for us, or some, some of the research that you've done that you'd like to share with us that's relevant to that bill, I'd ask you to get it to us and get it to staff so that we can include it in our.
I certainly would. One of the things I would just make a request is I would like to see a uniform statute of what is considered abuse, regardless of whether you're over 65, you have a developmental disability, or you have a psychiatric disability. To me, it just frustrates me that if somebody is doing financial fraud against a senior adult, that's punishable. And if they do it against somebody with psychiatric disability, it's not punishable. And that just infuriates me.
Well, we'll look forward to getting that information from you.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here this morning, Becky. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2351, and we'll reopen the public informational hearing on the mental health system. Next, we will invite up Drake Eubank. Or is it Eubank? I can't. Eubank, all right.
Brad and Andrew.
My name is Robert Drake Eubank. I'm appearing here as a private individual on my own time. I am affiliated with a 501c3 in Eugene, Springfield area called SAFE Incorporated, which is a peer-run nonprofit that has a budget of approximately $150,000 a year. I guess what I would like to talk about, besides some of the things that we do that are very cost-effective in the system, which I'm sure you're going to hear a lot more about as they try to screw down the budget to something they can afford, is the design of the system and the balance of resources. What you see right now is a system, psychiatric system, probably even a forensic and prison system that's designed by professionals, essentially somewhat by the inertia of the bureaucracy, hospitals, psychiatrists themselves, and often concepts offered by the pharmaceutical industry and their theories about mental illness. What you don't see to this point, even though Senate Bill 267 is in place, is a system that's designed with results as the focus and with the significant input of the people that receive the services and what works for them. Admittedly, there are a lot of people that have difficulty articulating that, but I think that there is not a great deal of effort made in a lot of areas to obtain those sorts of opinions, and I think they would be useful. I would like to give an example. I was at a lecture at the Eugene Public Library by Ron Unger, who is a mental health professional at one of the agencies in Eugene, on recovery. And one of the things that he presented was kind of interesting and perhaps illustrates the point I'm trying to make, that we did a study. It was a housing choices study where they gave professionals, part of a control group, the ability to make informed decisions for the clients on housing situations and services. And the other side of the control was basically turned over to the clients themselves. The outcomes from that study, basically in almost every case, were that the balance of the results were that the outcomes were better for the clients that made their own choices, which sort of defeats the notion that these people aren't able to decide for themselves what kinds of services, what kinds of treatments they want. I have personal experience of things somewhat similar that might be of interest to people that believe the mentally ill are totally disabled and unable to function in the society that we live in and need to be parented through the process of living their lives. I have very often had to buy food for people within the budget of our agency, and I will take them out, people that would be considered completely dysfunctional, unable to take care of their own needs, and we'll tell them, standing in Winco or what they choose is a store, which is usually the least expensive one, that they can spend $25 and no more. I will walk around that store, and that person will be able to find the most efficient and often very balanced diet that they can, and I have yet to have anybody, no matter what their disability, go over $26. So that says to me that on a practical level, that somewhere these people have functional ability that's not necessarily being reflected in the design of their services, if I can make that extended inference.
Should have some of those folks come shopping with me on the balance type.
Anyways, what I think I would like to speak to is the imbalance of resources as they relate to most people that I relate to, which are this people on the streets and people on the Oregon Health Plan. The agency that I work with is funded by the Oregon Health Plan. Deals basically with peer support, but we actually have build fee-for-service type services that deal specifically. We keep files and provide treatment, most of which are based on quality of life rather than counseling or therapy interventions. We hire our own mental health professional to supervise the work that our other staff people do, and that's kind of a significant part of what we do besides the outreach and drop-in center services, which are a straight carve-out, which means they're not attached to a specific client from the Oregon Health Plan, that we run community-based services. Anyways, what I guess I would like to speak to is the imbalance of resources when you consider that the current suggested budget by the governor, I think it comes to something like $249 million. $129 million of it is for the state hospital system. That's 650 patients. And that means that the general fund, all the crisis dollars that flow into the community, as well as any other services that take place any place but the state hospital, are funded at $9 million less than what those 650 people take out of your budget. And I'm, a person that believes that there are situations where acute care is a necessary component of a system of care, but by far the balance of the resources has been determined by acute care costs, which in my area are $850 a day for hospitalizing someone. We've actually had success taking people that had five-figure authorizations and utilizations in our areas and reducing that significantly just by providing ongoing support for those people, which the hospitals are getting wise to at this point. But to this point, there's no real back door in most communities. Once they turn them out of the hospital, they're back in the same exact situation they were before they became acute. And unfortunately, that makes it a revolving door, which is incredibly expensive when I think of what I can do with the acute care budget at the state or even my locality. We serve between 75 and 150 people in significant amounts at per hour. I guess I'd call it a standard service hour, which in the system is about $77 in our area. We serve them for less than 10 and get a lot more of their needs met because the system is inefficient in the sense that it can't can't just take somebody out to go get groceries. It can't go over to their house in the middle of the night. It can't have somebody ride in their van or their car without getting protected kinds of permissions and insurance. And those are
those all examples of the ongoing support that you were talking about?
That's the kinds of things we provide. We basically help people maintain their lives. We also, something that we do that essentially Lane Care, which is the MHO in our area, does in a smaller sense, but serves the same interest, is that our fee-for-service costs are low enough administratively that we take the excess and give it back to the clients. After we pay our staff and our administrative costs, we make that money available to them to do something with that money themselves that we see as them partly being entitled to and as well generating. And they use it for something that they're interested in that will improve their well-being. They can decide for themselves. It's been very successful. And kind of the parallel program with Lane Care, they know that because of the general fund lack of money in our area, they have a lot of people that don't have coverage. They end up taking part of their service dollars and part of, I guess, what would be a nonprofit's profit in that sense, which is the difference between what they spend and what they get, and reinvest it in community-based treatment for people that don't have coverage. Anyways, I guess I would like to move on to something called recovery. I am most gratified that NAMI has a desk out there that has a big, huge sign that celebrates recovery. And to some degree, again, this speaks to the empowerment of the people receiving the services. This is the first time I've actually appeared in Salem to testify on anything that wasn't a forced treatment bill, if that's some indication. And I welcome the banner of recovery out there, because that was started essentially by people that were not recognized and whose voices were not heard in either the legislative process or the policymaking process at the outset. That's the idea of people that basically would not accept that their illnesses were lifelong, biologically based, incurable, and hopeless. I think there's a lot to be said for the resourcefulness of those people that have picked themselves up and basically proved the system wrong enough that they've had to recognize that that is an important part of people's lives. Anyways, that pretty much is what I wanted to say while I was up here. You have a tremendous amount of money being spent, and I would hate to see it just repainting the same walls in the state hospital. So I think that's a place that for years now has been decrying that it doesn't have enough money, but hasn't, to my satisfaction, demonstrated that it's spent the money it's had very well. I'm not very, very well versed on the figures, but I think they paid $1 million in overtime to employees last biennium. And when I think what my system of care can do with that money, I'm just made dizzy. The one thing that I did want to say about the governor's task force, which I think is important, is they did emphasize the restructuring of the state hospital, recognizing that, because we can't use elephants for particular examples, the giraffe in the living room that everybody had tried not to do anything about. The lawyers that ran that task force basically looked at where the big dollars were, and they looked at the statements of people saying what the state hospital wants, that the state hospital gets, and what the pharmaceutical companies want, the pharmaceutical company get. Those are the kind of policies that came out of that were basically directed on restructuring the most expensive item. And I support their design as being a system of care. A system of care has to have balance, and right now the whole lower tier of all the systems of care that have been suggested are so radically unfunded that you have a guaranteed client population for years to come if you don't have some interventions that are lower than the hospital level. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Drake, you know, I just want to say, first of all, how much I appreciate your comments, your client-driven approach to caring for folks, and self-determination, that concept, is where clients, whether they're developmentally disabled or mentally ill or whatever their circumstances, I appreciate how you're allowing, or you're working with your clients to drive some of the decisions of their daily lives. So I think that really is the way to best serve folks. So I appreciate that. I'm going to have our staff get into contact with you, because I want to know a little bit more about your program down in Eugene, and also maybe ask you if you had written the task force for mental health, if you had written some kind of direction, maybe you'd like to let us know what that would look like, because I'd be really curious what your perspective would be. So if you could maybe spend some time in the future working with that and getting into that too, I would very much value your input. That sound like fine?
Thank you. Can I mention one other thing?
Sure.
There is a legislation, I guess at this point it's still a legislative concept, that was created by the State Consumer Council and in conjunction with the Real Change Grant at Omaha's, which has some significant components about self-determination and brokerage of services done by consumers. It is ideally going to be authored by someone before this session is out, and has no fiscal impact attached to it. It is a policy establishing type of bill that basically talks about some of the things here, as well as some of the oversights and budgetary, and giving the consumers some idea or some empowerment to have some opinion on the budgetary impacts of things.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We have three people left, Bob Dundep, Ken Stockamp, and Judy Wilson. So we'll have Bob come forward, please. Yeah, no, it's okay. I understand. Well, it's just me, so a lot of our colleagues have NAMI groups waiting for them in their offices to visit, and my NAMI group comes in at 11 o'clock, so I'll be here for another 15 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I welcome the opportunity to have a personal interview with you today.
That's great. Thank you.
And I will make my remarks brief. My name is Bob Dundep. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center. We're the Office for Protection Advocacy for People with Disabilities in Oregon. And I've been advocating for people with disabilities for over 20 years, and particularly with a focus for folks with mental illness. What I wanted to say is that I don't want to repeat things that other people have said, so I'll get right down to it. I think given the situation that we're in right now, there are some very important things that this committee can do. Sometimes times of tough fiscal problems can create opportunities to do other things that sometimes get pushed to the side. And part of that, of course, is planning, and part of that is revamping some archaic statutory systems that we have right now. And I just want to mention a few. One is, of course, the state hospital. You've heard a lot of testimony about that. There's some significant changes that need to be made in the way that the law moves people toward the hospital and away from the hospital. That's something that can be done at this point without fiscal impact, more of a housekeeping measure. And of
did
course,
you have some concepts? Or
there is a bill that we had, it's Senate Bill 250. It's over on the Senate side that would deal with the question of aid and assist folks coming out of the criminal system. And what it would do is it would give DHS more flexibility in terms of where to place those folks. Right now, those folks are mandated by law to be placed in the state hospital. Many need to be in a state hospital environment, but some don't. And if DHS had the authority to evaluate and place in the most appropriate setting, I think that would be a step forward in terms of allowing them to use their resources more effectively. What you heard earlier, House Bill 2362, which is in your committee, would initiate a planning process around system of care for kids' mental health services. And the idea here, of course, is to look at the various funding streams that come into kids' services for kids with severe mental health problems, and find a way to use them better, to wrap them around the child and the family. And you've seen these models in DD. These are models that work really well, and we can show you examples from other states where they've been implemented and work very efficiently. More broadly, we're really operating under a statutory framework that was created about 30 years ago in terms of our mental health system, and our mental health system has changed dramatically. I actually feel that in all the years that I've been doing this work, that we probably have the best leadership at the state and the best leadership in our advocacy organizations that we've had before, and the most coherence and ability to work together that we've ever had. So it's a golden opportunity to really sit down and look at those things and try to engineer them in such a way that they do emphasize recovery, that they do emphasize flexibility in the movement of people so that they get to the level of service that they need to be to get better the fastest and to remain healthy in the community for the longest period of time. So I think those opportunities are here for us right now. We can make some important changes, and I look forward to working with you to do that.
I appreciate it. Thanks for being here. Okay, Ken Stockham.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks for letting me speak. I'm an individual who 35 years ago was briefly on 1,500 milligrams of Thorazine, 70 milligrams of Dalazine concurrently, and was interned at Damish for 4.5 months. My name is Ken Stockham. It used to be a written cliche that writers like Thomas Saz would put into print. Certain individuals didn't thank them then, and they don't thank them now. I'm mellowing a little bit, because what it's given me is kind of a real intricate topic. I see that it's a difficult, how we treat mental illness is difficult for everyone. And some of the members of the audience already know that I'm going to say that I believe that the more medications we give, the worse it is for society. The psychiatric medications. It's hard for me to be sitting in at the steering committee for Partners in Crisis, and in the introductions have the person sitting to my right say, she's representing NAMI, by the way, say, well, I'm a bipolar, drugs are all we have. The medications are all we have. I go out of my way just to put myself in front of you to say that I wouldn't be here, I'm convinced, in my same capacity, if I hadn't put an end to those drugs. One of the most sad things I see on news groups is in the context of autism, somebody recognizing that he was given more of those medications because of the side effects that were manifest. Creates an interesting situation. Sometimes I think if nothing were done, it would be better than what's done when it includes medicating. So
did you have a recommendation for this committee?
Well, for me, that's nothing new to say that medications are overused.
Okay.
Just please include my opinion, that if you want to see other recovered schizophrenics, what do they call us, ambulatory schizophrenics, it also leads into other issues, though. My experience, I believe that in regard to parity, I think that as important as who's going to pay the bill for psychiatric treatment is an accurate differential diagnosis to begin with. Because I think there's a lot of us that don't necessarily have schizophrenia, but it was really, a system of chemistry that didn't tolerate toxins in a work environment or light in the environment when they're growing up or something like that.
Okay.
So that would be my second recommendation is an accurate differential diagnosis that could include an actual medical diagnosis that would be the appropriate focus of attention rather than something mental going on. In the other area, in the beginning when I said I was grateful for the experience of having something challenging to think about, I think it is really challenging for society to separate out the criminal from the rest. I realize we defer to certain individuals, the afflicted, the insanity defense. It doesn't change that we don't all have an equal claim to justice. With the way recovery is presented in its recent campaign, if you will, is that everybody has an equal claim to recovery. But I think we need to keep it in the back of our heads. Not everybody has an equal claim to justice. Even though I had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, I differentiate myself from some I read about in the newspaper who are possibly about to do great things and whatnot, but they stabbed somebody. I didn't stab anybody. But I will tell you that when I get back into the workplace, and by the way, Thomas Saw says that the truest thing, closest thing we have to a true panacea is work. It means, and that means, the reality of that means that employers who are kind of passing on to the people who are unlucky enough to be in that workplace, the shortcuts that they're taking in terms of exposing workers to toxins, or they're taking shortcuts in terms of safety, that as recovery would happen, it has to be anticipated that the people who in the past hadn't been afforded the luxury of recovery, they're going to need some special guidance.
Okay.
The only other closing thought is with the peer support and everything, it's really difficult. I think it's going to take some nurturing if you really want to see peers like myself. I look over my shoulder and I don't see anybody following. I look at other proclaimed leaders in the survivor consumer group. I don't see anybody following. But I think we have something to give.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Well, I appreciate you being here today, Ken.
Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And is Judy Wilson in the audience? I don't see Judy. We lost Judy. Okay. Well, with that, we will close our hearing.
I'll get this.